In this Australian Catholic Historical Society podcast for November 2023, we hear Dr. Stephen McInerney of Campion College, Sydney, presenting a panorama of Australian religious poetry through reading it. He's introduced by ACHS President Dr. John Carmody, who will also moderate the Q&A.
Some of you may remember that when Les Murray died, the great Australian poet Les Murray died, Stephen gave us an inspiring talk on Les and his poetry and his contribution to Australian literature and life. So I was very keen that we should get him back. He's a distinguished poet himself. He's a former CEO of the Ramsey Foundation, and he's now teaching literature at Campion College. So I'm very delighted that he's going to be talking to us today on a panorama of Australian religious poetry through reading it. And that's, I think, the essence of poetry. It's meant to be read. And I can remember Les was not a polished performer, but I've never encountered anybody who read Les's poetry better than he read it himself, because he knew where to lay the emphasis. He knew about the rhythms. He was very much focused on the rhythm of poetry. So I'm looking forward to hearing Stephen talk to us today. He's got a number of poems that he's going to read and then make a little comment on. And I look forward to the session with great interest. Thanks very much, Stephen.
Thanks, Jack. Thank you for coming. I thought I should start by at least explaining the choices that I've made or the reasons that I've chosen these poems. So Jack suggested the title A Panorama of Australian Religious Poetry, and I realise it's not really a panorama that I'm providing. I had to restrict myself in some way. So I've restricted myself to the 20th century, and I've restricted myself to poets who are outstanding poets in their own right, irrespective of the religious content of their work. And then I had to decide really what counts as a religious poem. And this is somewhat problematic. The great Anglo-Welsh poet R.S. Thomas published an anthology, which I've got here, called The Penguin Book of Religious Verse in the 1970s. And he sort of negotiated this problem that poetry is itself, historically, has been seen as a sort of sacred thing. Way back in the ancient world, Socrates in the Platonic dialogue Ion says to Ion, poetry is a sacred and many-winged thing. And, you know, more recently, Les Murray, whom Jack mentioned, in his famous poem about religion and poetry, says religions are poems. So if this is true, then any reading of any poems would be a reading of religious poems. But I needed, obviously, to find a more manageable definition than that. So what I've done is essentially to select poems which themselves either draw on some religious image or refer to a religious ritual or a religious idea or a phenomenon, whether or not the poet, him or herself, was a practicing member of a particular religious tradition. Because we're talking about Australian poetry in the 20th century, we're predominantly talking about a Christian frame of reference. I'm not reading from translations of Indigenous song cycles, although I could have done that, and of course they represent a significant part of the sacred patrimony or treasury of Australian religious poetry, but I didn't feel at all competent to select from that tradition in translation with all the problems associated with that. So the poems either refer to or represent some religious idea, religious ritual, phenomenon, and whether or not the poet is him or herself religious. So I'm going to read probably 10 poems, one by Lesbia Harford, one by Alec Hope, one by Judith Wright, one by James McCauley, one by Francis Webb, one by Peter Porter, a poem by Liz Murray, a poem by Robert Gray, a poem by Kevin Hart, and a poem by Noel Rowe. Depending on the time, I might read one of my own, and that will be that. And in each case, I might explain a couple of references, and and after reading it, I might explain perhaps something in the poem that appealed to me when I chose it for today. So the first poem I'm going to read is by Lesbia Harford. The historical side of this is that I'm keeping to the chronology, that the poems that I'm reading are in the order of the poet's birth. Some of these poems, probably half of them, are by poets who were either practicing Catholics or were formed in the Catholic tradition. So Lesbia Harford was not a practicing Catholic, but she was educated by the nuns at Sacre Coeur in Melbourne and the nuns at Loretto in Ballarat. And in her last years, she died in her mid-30s, but in her last years, apparently had returned in her own private way to reciting regularly the prayers from the liturgy and the office of the church in Latin. So she's a really fascinating woman. This poem is called Summer Lightning. It's a very short lyric. It's 8 lines. Just now, as warm day faded from our sight, hosts of archangels, fleet on lightning-winged feet, passed by, all glimmering in the busy night. Sweet angels, bring no blinding truth to birth. Give us no messages from heavenly palaces. Leave us our dark trees and our starlight earth. This really appeals to me because, in a sense, it's the opposite of one normally expects in a religious poem. A common, almost cliched trope now is the idea of a religious poem is one that finds the extraordinary in the ordinary. This is a very sort of modern preoccupation. In fact, it's my own preoccupation. But what I love about this is that it's this sense that we've all had, I'm sure, of being overwhelmed by the presence of the sacred and feeling at the same time that that presses too much upon us, and simply wanting the ordinary things that have been given to us, which have also been given to us by the same source, by the same original source. And I love that. Leave us our dark trees and our starlight earth. There's a reason that angels don't typically appear to us, because they occlude the wonderful things that are around us all the time. The next poem is by Alec Hope, not a religious man in any formal sense. In fact, his friendship with James McCauley sort of diverged at the point where James McCauley embraced Catholicism. But Alec Hope wrote this wonderful poem on the death of Pius XII. And it's a poem of, you know, he's talking about the fall, the autumn, as he was experiencing it in the Northern Hemisphere in the United States at the time. He was visiting Amherst College. And while there, someone walking through the college grounds said, "The Pope is dead." And so he relates what he's experiencing in the autumnal atmosphere with the death of Pius XII. To every season its proper act of joy, to every age its natural mode of grace, each vision its hour, each talent we employ its destined time and place. I was at Amherst when this great Pope died. the northern year was wearing towards the cold. The ancient trees were in their autumn pride of russet, flame and gold. Amherst in Massachusetts in the fall. I ranged the college campus to admire maple and beech, poplar and ash in all their panoply of fire. Something that since a child I longed to see, this miracle of the other hemisphere. Whole forests in their annual ecstasy, waked by the dying year. Not budding spring, nor summer's green parade, clothed in such glory, these resplendent trees. The lilies of the field were not arrayed in riches such as these. Nature evolves their colours as a call, a lure which serves to fertilise the seed. How strange, then, that the splendour of the fall should serve no natural need. And having no end in nature, yet can yield such exquisite natural pleasure to the eye. Who could have guessed in summer's green concealed the leaf's resolve to die? Yet from the first spring shoots through all the year, masked in the chlorophyll's intenser green, the feast of crimson was already there. These yellows blazed unseen. Now in the bright October sun, the clear translucent colours trembled overhead. And as I walked, a voice I chanced to hear announced, "The Pope is dead." A human voice. Yet there the place became Bethel. Each bough with Pentecost was crowned. The great trunks wrapped in unconsuming flame stood as on holy ground. I thought of this old man whose life was past, who in himself and his great office stood against the secular tempest as a vast oak spans the underwood, who in the age of Armageddon found a voice that caused all men to hear it plain, the blood of Abel crying from the ground to stay the hand of Cain, who found from that great task small time to spare. For him and for mankind the hour was late, so much to snatch, to save, so much to bear that Mary's part must wait, until in his last years the change began, a strange illumination of the heart, voices and visions such as mark the man chosen and set apart. His death, they said, was slow, grotesque and hard. Yet in that gross decay, until the end, untroubled in his joy, he saw the Word made spirit and ascend. Those glorious woods and that triumphant death prompted me there to join their mysteries. This brother Albert, this great oak of faith, those fire-enchanted trees. 7 years have passed, and still at times I ask whether in man, as in those plants, may be a splendour which his human virtues mask, not given to us to see. If to some lives, at least, there comes a stage when all the active man now left behind, they enter on the treasure of old age, this autumn of the mind. Then, while the heart stands still, beyond desire, the dying animal knows a strange serene, emerging in its ecstasy of fire, the burning soul is seen. Who sees it? Since old age appears to men senility, decrepitude, disease, what spirit walks among us past our ken, as we among these trees, whose unknown nature, blessed with keener sense, catches its breath in wonder at the sight and feels its being flood with that immense epiphany of light. The next one is by Judith Wright, called For One Dying. Come now, the angel leads. All human lives betray. All human love erodes under time's laser ray. The innocent animals within us and without die in corrupted hells made out of human thought. Green places and pure springs are poisoned and laid bare. Even the hawk's high wings ride on fatal air. But come, the angel calls. Deep in the dreamer's cave, the one pure source upwells its single luminous wave. And there, recorder, seer, you wait within your cell. I bring in love and fear the world I know too well into your hands. Receive these fractured days I yield. Renew the life we grieve by day to know and hold. Renew the central dream in blazing purity and let my rags confirm and robe eternity. For still the angel leads. Ruined yet pure we go with all our days and deeds into that flame, that snow. This line in that, ruined yet pure we go, which is to me a perfect description of our state and held as we are in that state, passing from it to God, ruined yet pure we go. Now, this is James Macaulay. This is one of, I mean, all of these are great Australian poems, whether they're great Australian religious poems or not, but this poem is the triumph of James Macaulay's career, in my view, because... And perhaps that's because it's a moment where he was much less self-assured than he was at other times. Because my father and my mother never quarrelled. They were united in a kind of love as daily as the Sydney Morning Herald, rather than like the eagle or the dove. I never saw them casually touch or show a moment's joy in one another. Why should this matter to me now so much? I think it bore more hardly on my mother, who had more generous feeling to express. My father had dammed up his Irish blood against all drinking, praying, fecklessness, and stiffened into stone and creaking wood. His lips would make a switching sound as though spontaneous impulse must be kept at bay. That it was mainly weakness, I see now. But then my feelings curled back in dismay. Small things can pit the memory like a cyst. Having seen other fathers greet their sons, I put my childish face up to be kissed after an absence. The rebuff still stuns my blood. The poor man's curt embarrassment at such a delicate proffer of affection cut like a saw. But home the lesson went. My tenderness thenceforth escaped detection. My mother sang Because and Annie Laurie, White Wings and other songs. Her voice was sweet. I never gave enough, and I am sorry, but we were all closed in the same defeat. People do what they can. They were good people. They cared for us and loved us. Once they stood tall in my childhood as the school, the steeple. How can I judge without ingratitude? Judgment is simply trying to reject a part of what we are because it hurts. The living cannot call the dead collect. They won't accept the charge, and it reverts. It's my own judgment day that I draw near, descending in the past without a clue, down to that central deadness, the despair older than any hope I ever knew. This is Francis Webb. Five Days Old, which is a great poem to be reading this time of the year, I think. And it has one of the best images of the incarnation in all of literature, I think. And it was occasioned by him meeting a newborn baby and being handed this newborn baby, to whom he dedicates the poem for Christopher John. Christmas is in the air. You are given into my hands out of quietest, loneliest lands. My trembling is all my prayer. To blown straw was given all the fullness of heaven. The tiny, not the immense, will teach our groping eyes. So the absorbed skies bleed stars of innocence. So cloud voice in war and trouble is at last Christ in the stable. Now wonderingly engrossed in your fearless delicacies, I am launched upon sacred seas, humbly and utterly lost in the mystery of creation. Bells, bells of ocean. Too pure for my tongue to praise, that sober, exquisite yawn of the gradual, generous dawn at an eyelid, maker of days. To shrive my thought for perfection, I must breathe old tempests of action, for the snowflake and face of love. Windfall and word of truth, honour close to death. O eternal truthfulness, dove, tell me what I hold. Myrrh, frankincense, gold. If this is man, then the danger and fear are as lights of the inn, faint and remote as sin out here by the manger. In the sleeping, weeping weather, we shall all kneel down together. I love how that poem moves from this very particular encounter with a child to a vision at the end of the whole of humanity, through all of history, through all of time. So it's pointing towards the end of things as well. In the sleeping, weeping weather, we shall all kneel down together. This next poem is by Peter Porter, and it's probably my favourite of the poems that I'm reading today. Peter Porter's first wife took her own life when they had two teenage girls, I think, at the time that his first wife took her own life. And he wrote a collection of poems, The Cost of Seriousness, which is, in a way, as remarkable an achievement as the poems of Thomas Hardy from 1912-13 about the death of his wife. And this poem is a poem really where we see the poet expressing his guilt, expressing his guilt for the part that he has played, the part that he played in her demise, and also looking fondly at their shared life together and looking more grimly at the future without her. There are a couple of allusions that I should probably explain. The last is, and I hope I get this right, I turned my phone off, but I had to look it up, but the last line is German from a Beethoven sonata, Fürchte dich nicht, ich bin bei dir. It conveys this idea that of God being near us. Here it's the poet saying that he will be near her. This is an exequy, so that itself is an allusion to another poem written, which he refers to in this poem itself, for another dead wife. In wet May, in the months of change, in a country you wouldn't visit, strange dreams pursue me in my sleep. Black creatures of the upper deep. Though you are 5 months dead, I see you in guilt's iconography. Dear wife, lost beast, beleaguered child, the stranded monster with the mild appearance, whom small waves tease. Andromeda upon her knees in orthodox deliverance. And you alone of pure substance, the unformed form of life, the earth which Piero's brushes brought to birth for all to greet as myth, a thing out of the box of imagining. This introduction serves to sing your mortal death, as Bishop King once hymned in tetrametric rhyme his young wife, lost before her time. Though he lived on for many years, his poem each day fed new tears to that unreaching spot, her grave. His lines, a Baroque architrave, the Sunday poor with bottled flowers would bypass in their morning hours, esteeming ragged natural life, most dearly loved, most gentle wife. Yet looking back, when at the gate, and seeing grief in formal state upon a sculpted angel group, we're glad that men of God could stoop to give the dead a public stance and freeze them in their mortal dance. The words and faces proper to my misery are private. You would never share your heart with those whose only talents to suppose, nor from your fatal childish bed raise a remote confessing head. The channels of our lives are blocked. The hand is stopped upon the clock. No one can say why hearts will break and marriages are all opaque. A map of loss, some posted cards, the living house reduced to shards, the abstract hell of memory, the pointlessness of poetry. These are the instances which tell of something which I know full well. I owe a death to you. One day the time will come for me to pay, when your slim shape from photographs stands at my door and gently asks if I have any work to do, or will I come to bed with you? O Scala Enigmatica, I'll climb up to that attic where the curtain of your life was drawn sometime between despair and dawn. I'll never know with what halt steps you mounted to this plain eclipse, but each stair now will station me a black responsibility and point me to that shut down room, this be your due appointed tomb. I think of us in Italy, gin and Chianti fueled, we move in a trance through paradise, feeding at last our starving eyes, two people of the English blindness, doing each masterpiece the kindness of discovering it. From Baldo Vinetti to Venice's most obscure jetty. A true unfortunate traveller, I depend upon your nurse's eye to pick the altars where no grinner puts us off our tourist dinner, and in hotels to bandy words with Genevan girls and talking birds, to wear your feet out following me to night's end and true amity, and call my rational fear of flying a paradigm of holy dying. And oh, my love, I wish you were once more with me, at night somewhere, in narrow streets applauding wines, the moon above the Apennines, as large as logic and the stars, most middle-aged of avatars, as bright as when they shone for truth upon untried and avid youth. The rooms and days we wandered through shrink in my mind to one. There you lie quite absorbed by peace. The calm which life could not provide is balm in death. Unseen by me, you look past bed and stairs and half-read book eternally upon your home, the end of pain, the left alone. I have no friend or intercessor, no psychopomp or true confessor, but only you who know my heart in every cramped and devious part. Then take my hand and lead me out. The sky is overcast by doubt. The time has come. I listen for your words of comfort at the door. Oh, guide me through the shoals of fear. Verk dich nicht, ich bin bei dir. Jack mentioned I gave a paper on Les Murray a few years ago now. Otherwise I would have read quite a few of Les's, but I'll restrict myself to one. This is the mouthless image of God in the Hunter Kolo Mountains. And it comes from a time when Les lived on the North Shore and had, I think at one point, part-time work as at one of the train stations on the Upper North Shore line, and would amuse himself by trying to get the dogs in the neighbouring houses to start barking, and how he'd get one dog to bark and then it would lead to a whole chorus of dogs, if chorus is the right word, by the end of the shift. The mouthless image of God in the Hunter Kolo Mountains. Starting a dog in the past midnight suburbs for a laugh, barking for a lark, or to nark and miff, being tough or dumbly meditative, starting gruff, sparking one dog off almost companionably, you work him up, playing the rough riff of punkish mischief. Get funky as a poultry farm diff and vary with the Prussian note, Achtungskrr, gruff, starting all the dogs off for the tinny chain reaction and stiff far-spreading music, the backyard territorial guff echoing off back streets, garbage cans, off every sandstone cliff in miles-wide canine circles, a vast haze of auditory stuff with every dog augmenting it, tail up, mouth serrated, shoulder rough, pulsing with its outputs, a continuous clipped yap from a handmuff Pomeranian, a Labrador's ascending fours, a Dane grown great enough to bark in the singular, many raffish bitzers blowing their gaff as humans raise windows and cries and here and there the roof, and you barking at the epicentre, you putting a warp to the woof, shift the design with a throat-rubbing lull and ill howl, dingo vibrant, not shrill, which starts a howling school among hill and hollow barkers, till horizons wide again, a tall pavilion of mixed timbers is lifted up eerily in full call, and the wailing takes a toll. You, from playing the fool, move, behind your arch will, into the sorrow of a people. And not just one people. You've entered a sound proletariat, where pigs exclaim, boff, boff, making off in fright, and fowls say, chirk, in tiny voices when a snake's about. Quite unlike the rooster's chook chook, meaning, look, a good bit, hens get stuck into it. Where the urgent boar mutters root root to his small harassed sow, trotting back and forth beside her, rut rut, and the she-cat's curdling meow, where are kittens, mutating to prmeow, come along, kittens, are quite different words from prow, general welcome and acceptance, or extremities portmanteau, meow. Active and passive at once, the boar and feeding sow share a common prone un, expressing repletion and bestowing it. And you're where the staid dog excited emits a mouth skirl he was trying to control and looks ashamed of it. And the hawk above the land calls himself Peter P. P. Pew, where, far from class hatred, the rooster scratches up some for you and edgy plovers sharpen their nerves on a blurring wheel. Water birds address you in their neck flexure language, hiss and bow, and you speak to each species in the 7 or 8 planetary words of its language, which ignore and include the detail God set you to elaborate by the dictionary for, when because they would reveal their every secret, he took definition from the beasts and gave it to you. If at baying time you have bayed with dogs and not humans, you know enough not to scorn the moister dimensions of language, not to build on the sandbanks of dry. You long to show someone non-human the diaphragm shuffle which may be your species' only distinctive cry, the spasm which in various rhythms turns our face awry, contorts speech, shakes the body, and makes our eyelids liquefy. Approaching adulthood, one half of this makes us shy, and the other is a touchy spear haft we wield for balance. Laughter and weeping. It's the great term, the small terms qualify, as a whale is qualified by all the near glitters of the sea. Weightless leviathan, our showering words overlie and modify. It rises irresistibly. All our dry-eyed investigations supply that one term in the end. Its occasions multiply. The logics issue in horror. We are shattered by joy till the old prime divider bends and its two ends unify and the learned words bubble off us. We laugh because we cry. The crying depth of life is too great not to laugh. But laugh or cry singly aren't it. Only mingled are they spirit to wobble and sing us as a summer dawn sings a magpie. For spirit is the round earth bringing our flat earths to bay, and we're feasted and mortified, exposed to those momentary heavens which, speaking in speech on the level, we work for and deny. This next one is by Robert Gray, who would hate, I think, to be described as a religious poet. So I'm not going to describe him as a religious poet, but religion comes up time and again in his work. And this is called, I'll just find it, After Heraclitus. Late to lie awake in a borrowed house in the country, in a forest of rain, hearing its fine traffic, or the deeply held tone of cello strings softly drawn. One knows oneself at this hour. The range is guilt or obsession with loss or fearfulness or fear for another. One lies drenched in thought. The human is excess of consciousness. For me, it has been the hands and feet caught below the gunwale from the dark, and I trying to pull those figures up out of the waters. They become inert. They are unable to come in. And there are others, although with them it is they and not I want possession, and they are limber. I have been unlatching them, not too unkindly, I would like to think, but over and again. You will make it on your own, I say. It's overloaded here, will sink, having to push away faces I've known or have loved. Economies are imposed upon the heart. I take up a book and wish the day would break. Even the tight bulrushes under the boughs along the creek will be soaked full by now, sopping in the warp of lightning. A shimmer from the garden, the rubber gloves drawn on. Women are nature's victims, and we are theirs, and they are ours. What rockets, what shout, what furies of hurt, what adhesive fire. And wrapping itself about itself, the ancient rain comes reeling through the paddocks. How exaggerated one's regrets are in the crisis, the crossing point of night. At daybreak, I lie on the floor of an entangled pond, looking up through the murk to where the webfoot leaves are treading the surface in dimness. I understand it is death for the soul to grow sodden. I hear what could seem a paper umbrella being tapped upon with a Japanese sparsity and calm. The sun is able to kindle in such a soaking world again. The sleepers dream in a world where each is their own, but the daylight world is ours in common. One steps into the river as a river. Within an hour, I walk in the garden, hung around by mulberry, persimmon, palms with low fronds, and oleander. In their shade stand, more scintillant than Manhattan's night from an airline flight, all these grass-tall spires of rain. The wattle that's clothed in spindled leaves is thickly starred with a shaggy bright water as though it were the Milky Way. I try to picture how the light takes everywhere it rides. Across the valleys, across the hills, those uncounted cells of water which are seeds. There's a fruit lit in the lap of each leaf, at the tip of every black stick. The close fields are as ripe as oil paint. In a wind, higher up on the ridge, the tree line is deciduous as a clarinet. Steam rises in the forest gate. How this light exceeds Corot's unshakable dew. We know there's no pause to the brute secateurs, and yet we must think, hail, hail, holy light. Although it's not the offspring of heaven's sun, it is the lightning from the start of time and our blessedness, even as it keeps the nature of flame. And the last poem I'm going to read, well, I'll read one of my own to finish, but before that, the last in the The selection I chose is by Noel Rowe, who was here for a time, I think, at St Patrick's, and not long after his ordination. And eventually he ended up at the University of Sydney in the English department, where I met him. This poem was dedicated to Father Jim Essler. I don't know if any of you know or knew Jim Essler. And it's from a sequence called Magnificat, and it's called The Resurrection. Oh, actually, I meant to read Kevin Hart too, so I'll do that after this, sorry. Yes, Simeon, there was sorrow, but much fun too when he set about making contradiction. I should have known, for when the glorias first were sung, it was to celebrate my son, born among the dung. Ever since, I've been hearing heaven's laughter. Cana's newlyweds, absorbed in what was coming after, did not even notice how the water changed its mind. The Pharisees got a holy shock as a man born blind told them if they didn't get a hold on their desires, so taken up with Christ, they'd land themselves among his followers. Sacred irreverence. It is a gift to those found free in the spirit. Even Zacchaeus found it in himself up a tree, and Lazarus sauntering around in his shroud. There was a time too when, expecting stones, a crowd got instead some bread and fish. I heard a thief steal his way back to paradise. The structure of the real is mercy. Having seen so many reversals, I should have known he would test his muscles on the stone and walk away from the dazed grave, leaving its mouth open and amazed. And this is Kevin Hart's poem, The Gift. The gift, I think, being grace, but he doesn't use that word. The gift. One day, the gift arrives outside your door, left on a windowsill, inside the mailbox, or in the hallway, far too large to lift. Your postman shrugs his shoulders. The police consult a statute, and the cat meows. No name, no signature, and no address. Only to you, my dearest one, my all. One day it fits snugly in your pocket, then fills the backyard like afternoon in spring. Monday morning, and it's there at work, already ahead of you, all left behind amongst the papers, files, and photographs. And were there lipstick smudges down the side, or have they just appeared? What a headache. And worse, people have begun to talk. You lucky thing, they say, or roll their eyes. Evenings find you combing the directory, a glass of straw-coloured wine upon the desk, still hoping to chance on a forgotten name. Yet mornings see you happier than before. After all, the gift has set you up for life. Impossible to tell now what was given and what was not. Slivers of rain on the window, that gold-tooled oeuvre of Diderot on the shelf, the strawberry dreaming in a champagne flute. Were they part of the gift or something else? Or is the gift still coming on its way? So I'll just end with a poem of mine. This is called While Children Died. There's a great Buddhist monk, Thich Nhat Hanh. Some of you probably heard of him. And he sort of promoted this idea of engaged Buddhism during the Vietnam War. He met Thomas Merton and Martin Luther King, and he became very famous in his own right. But he was confronted by this problem, I suppose, the problem for the contemplative, of what it means to go into this space, this contemplative space, and remain in that space at the same time as you know that just there, there is someone else who needs your help, your practical help, or who is suffering in some respect. How do you hold those two things in balance, recognizing the necessity of the contemplative life at the same time as one recognizes the demands of the active life? This poem wasn't inspired by that, but it, as I've come to realize afterwards, after writing it, in a certain way, it explores the same idea. For years I have wanted this. Words, empty desk, wind outside. I want to ask forgiveness. For what? Desires that you have given and not given. Desires that you permit but do not approve. Desires that you approve but do not permit. The lives that you have given and taken away. The wind outside. Sin is your absence, but your presence recalls us to our sin. Without confusion, without change, without division, without separation, begotten, not made, flesh, through whom, for us, all things broken and distributed. Do this, remember. Smoke rising over Botany. Orange and yellow lights, a single car on Botany Road, containers and container ships. Even here on this road, even now, her lips, her throat, her neck, her hair, in you, in three, noli me tangere, the pulped flesh, eating grilled fish, dressed and undressed in declensions and conjugations, inflected and uninflected tongues that taste you, tongues that utter your name and embrace you, tongues that press themselves into your side and feed, tongues, the gift of tongues. I am mad for it to be in contact with me. That's a quotation from Whitman, I should have explained. I am mad for it to be in contact with me, observing a spear and the membrane between your life and mine, better than I know myself. The hills, when I speak of them, the sea, when it folds me in its dreams, the sea light of my waking, dappled on the ceiling, my hairs on the pillow when I lie down, which you have numbered and known while children died. I'll finish there. I think that's about time. Jack?
Thanks very much, Stephen. I think we've heard something really quite extraordinary. Not just of the range of people some of us would have known, but what great poetry has been written in this country. And you mentioned one of the people you met read was Jim McCauley, and I'm reminded that Dick Connolly once said of Jim's poetry, which he said in the memorable Hymns for the Year of Grace, he only had to hear the words. He only had to hear the words, and the music came to him. And I'm reminded of a poem. He grew up an Anglican and converted to Catholicism, and one of his poems is Table Talk. In Table Talk, my father used to tell of the escaped nun kidnapped by a priest, of innocent girls in the confessional, closeted in the dark with some gross beast. By contrast, Anglican restraint was good. It kept religion in its proper place, where all the table talk was for. And I understood only long after, but it left a trace. And the last word is, we took in daily with the mutton roast, the corned beef salad, and the shepherd's pie. So we've heard great poetry, beautifully read, and very well selected. Thanks very much. Now, there must be other people who have got comments or observations. Are you all numbed into silence by those great writers?
Thank you. Thanks very much. It's so much unspoken stuff, and the way you've delivered it all was beautiful. I think we've been taken into a mystical world, just sitting here listening to you. Not a lot of geometric form, shape, all the rest, but just beautiful ideas and things that we've probably all experienced but can't articulate. Who is the poet that you said he wouldn't want to be, was it Hunt, wouldn't want to be known as a religious poet?
Robert Gray.
Was that the one where you sort of went into nature and the forest and the colours and all that? That was just so mystical, I thought. And then the very first poem, I thought I was picking up on some Aboriginal spirituality with the sense of the feel of people who have deceased being around us. And you did mention about Aboriginal poetry at the beginning, and I thought, yes, I think it's in there as well. Maybe it's something we all share in common, but we don't know how to express it in words. Maybe our Christian tradition cut us off from that. So thank you so much. I don't have a question other than to say thank you very much for taking us into that mystical world this afternoon. Thank you.
That reminds me, Stephen, I was very pleased that you began with Lesbia Harford, because she, having died young, was promptly forgotten. And I think only quite recently there's been a reassessment in a biography published of her. One of our great poets. So, if for nothing else, you should send us to her to read what she wrote. Robert.
Oh, Stephen, thanks very much indeed for your beautiful reading of those poems. If I may, I have a question relating to your own poem, the last one you read. And I was, among other things, so impressed by the way you so, as it were, devotedly wove into the Chalcedonian definition into that. Not to mention other gospel verses, but you've entitled the poem as When Children Die, and of course all of us recently have been in anguish watching the news. I wonder, would you mind commenting on your choice of that title in relation to the content of the poem? Thanks very much.
I suppose it's just the, without wanting to dramatise it too much, the problem of, you know, theodicy and so on. So what does it mean to...
Could you speak into the mic?
Yes. The problem of theodicy, what does it mean to enter, in this case, into prayer or a dialogue with God at the very same moment that one is conscious that there is terrible suffering going on just anywhere in the world, that one knows those two things are happening at the same time. And so it ends with, you know, you know the numbers of the hairs on my head and so on, the fallen on the pillow, and you know this, which is an image of, you know, drawn from the scriptures, but an image of intimacy, that God has this knowledge of us and love for us and care for us and concern for us. And how do we hold that in our minds, in our imaginations, at the same time as we're aware of the problem of suffering, the problem of evil? So it really starts out as, for years I have wanted this. You know, it's the freedom or the opportunity to sit at an empty desk and write and think about things, and then entering into a sort of dialogue with God about the problem of evil. So in that sense, it's not original, but it's the point wasn't to be original, but simply to convey that feeling. What does it mean to And that's why years later, after I wrote the poem and I saw an interview with Thich Nhat Hanh, and he talked about this problem of being in a meditation in his monastery in Vietnam while people, villages were being bombed just nearby, and recognising that he'd given his life, you know, he'd given himself to the contemplative life, and he knew why that was important, but how to reconcile that with this immediate need that others have of us at any given time, at the same time as just knowing that this is always happening, even when, the monk is in his or her, the nun is in her cell, or when we're in the liturgy, when we're deep in prayer, at that very moment, there's terrible things happening. And I suppose it's that moment. I suppose for Christians, we have a not a solution, I suppose, but the liturgy is God Himself, making present of the suffering that God Himself took on in His human nature. So that, I suppose, is how it's resolved for in our tradition. That's where that poem went, I suppose. It's free association, so it's trying to, as you say, it has the Chalcedonian definition without change and so on, without separation. But it's looking at what that means in relation to the drama of human history and suffering, which ultimately comes, not that it's willed by God, but comes as a consequence of a decision, if decision is the right term, of God to create from nothing. You know, in a sense, it all flows from that, which we know isn't something that's necessitated by the divine nature, but a gratuitous gift to create, and yet attendant upon that decision to create is the awareness that human suffering is going to flow from it. So it's that drama, that paradox that the poem is. That's more dramatic, I think, than the poem captures, but that's what it's trying to gesture towards.
Jared.
That was wonderful, Stephen. Thanks so much. It just has the effect of I must go back and read all those poems again and more poems as well. I'm interested. I had a good discussion with my friend Matt Gibbs after Mass this morning, which we do, and about Catholic culture. And I was just wondering if you got any thoughts about denominational differences, at least in Australia, when it comes to writing poetry. For example, contrast normal Catholicism, let's say, with the Sydney Archdiocese and culture and the rest of it. You think there's much more at the disposal of a Catholic poet than there would be of an Anglican poet and so on. But anything you have to say, I'm interested in on denominational differences and so on.
Yeah, that's a really interesting question, Jared. I haven't thought a lot about it. I mean, I think writers, I mean, Robert Gray has talked to me about this actually, and he's talked about a Baroque tradition in Australian poetry, and he sees Les in that, and even himself, at the same time as he would see himself as informed by a kind of Puritan attitude to literature. Not in the worst sense, I don't mean in the sense of pure negation, but something chastened and restrained. And so there's that. I think culturally, people from who are sort of raised in one of the apostolic churches, in Catholicism or in the Orthodox churches and so on, have a longer and, in that sense, richer series of resources to draw from. But then again, within Protestantism, because of its emphasis on the written word, there is often a lot more attention. So, you know, Robert Gray grew up, his mother became a Jehovah Witness, and he was sort of forced to read the Bible every day, which I suspect is not something in the old days that young Catholics did a lot of. But then Catholics had that rich liturgical tradition and tradition of religious art and so on. But then where are we in 2023? I don't know really among young writers whether it's something that they're at all conscious of. It's a really interesting, really interesting. I need more time to think about it. I mean, I teach young Catholics predominantly, but also some young, very sort of devout, if that's the right word for Protestant, devout or earnest, or I don't know what the right word is, but serious.
Staunch.
That's right. Staunch Protestants, but not so staunch that they won't come to Campion. Right? So, they tend to be biblically literate. The Catholics tend to have a greater, they're more comfortable with art, they're more comfortable with film, with music. They're more comfortable, not always, as soon as you break beneath the surface, it comes out, but often officially they're not. But as soon as you get beneath the surface, they're more comfortable seeing the sacred lurking in places where it's not supposed to lurk. And so that, I think, is more likely to lead to art. But people, often artists, well, you know, often artists work, the constraints that they inherit through their upbringing, often those constraints provide a necessary form, a sort of concentration which allows them to work. So it can be, great art can be produced in any tradition and is. But yeah, that's a really fascinating question. I wish I could answer it, but I'm going to think more about it.
Thank you very much for your presentation. I found it very interesting and very, very deep and mystical, although it caused me to think about some more light-hearted Australian poetry. John O'Brien and Sidney Hartigan and his use of Australian vernacular, "We'll All Be Runes," of Al Anrahan. And also, I think one of my favourite poems is Tangmalang Maloo.
Day before the races at Tangmalangaloo.
I'm so grateful that you chose 5 days old.
I think that's an absolute miracle.
Yes, it is.
Miracle of wonder and quiet, incandescent quietness or something.
It's just, and it's the place where Francis Webb gives up a lot of the overly Baroque language, I think. Just it's a much more direct, plain poem.
Yes, that's a marvellous thing. I bought it with me.
Yeah.
Too pure. Thank you. Now wonderingly engrossed on your in your fearless delicacies, I am launched upon sacred seas, humbly and utterly lost in the mystery of creation. Bells of ocean. Too pure for my tongue to praise that sober, exquisite yawn, or the gradual, generous dawn of an eyelid maker of days. To shrive my thought for perfection, I must breathe old tempest of action. Difficult line, that, but beautiful. Thank you for reading that one.
No, you're very welcome.
And the Joe Piccoli recorders, too. I had a wonderful story about Joe Piccoli. That terrible last stanza where he says, "It is my own judgment day that I go near, descending into the past without a clue, down to that central deadness, that despair older than any hope I ever knew." And somebody touched something terribly deep in me about childhood fears, childhood lostness.
Yeah.
And I said, I'd love to talk to you about that. And I had the chance. Mears, Father John Mears, who was at Sir John's College, had us there for an evening.
Greg
Mears, yeah, with Macaulay. And Macaulay says, I'm going to read you this, and he read it to me. And I didn't say, talk to me about that terrible, terrible line. This is my own judgment day that I go near, descending into the past without a clue, down to that central deadness, that despair older than any hope I ever knew. What a terrible...
It is. It's very... It seems grim initially, but the fact that the despair is older than the hope doesn't mean that it's more abiding than the hope necessarily.
No.
Or that the hope is not there. It simply means that it's more primitive.
It's just revisiting it.
Yeah. And I think what the wonderful, I suppose, revelation in the poem that he comes to when it's my own judgment day that I draw near is he's resisting, you know, he's conscious that he has made mistakes just as his parents and his father made mistakes. And he's resisting the urge to blame them for everything. And also he becomes, as the poem progresses, more and more sympathetic with his father. You know, he understands what it was in his father that made it difficult for him to kiss this little boy who needed...
Oh, that's a terrible...
Yeah, it is. And part of it, I mean, it comes up elsewhere in Macaulay's work, is that, you know, his father had to, in a sense, repress his own religious longings and so on because of the circumstances of their marriage. And I think would often, it comes up in different poems, would sometimes under his breath be reciting prayers from his childhood and so on, the Salve Regina or something. But then when his wife would walk in, he'd stop. And the young boy picked this up and saw this sort of longing in his father, which he couldn't, because of the circumstances of their marriage, couldn't fulfil. So,
Stephen, what was the name of the Les Murray poem? And what is the... what's the name of the Les Murray poem? And what's the name of the Peter Porter, the line that you chose? You said you liked those.
The Les Murray poem is The Mouthless Image of God in the Hunter Colo Mountains. And the Porter poem is an exequy.
Thank you very much indeed for your inspiring talk. You mentioned Father Jim Esler, SM. I'll speak to you about how I knew him later. When I first started teaching many years ago now, there was an old book, even then a very small book, called The Rudiments of Literary Criticism. And the point was made that those of us who have not written poetry realise that the poet is someone who knows a word that we know, but he knows exactly where to put the word. And I am still reminded of that since I read it in 1953 when I go by train over the Sydney Harbour Bridge. Looking down at the water, I think of the wrinkled sea beneath him crawls, written about a man looking down at the sea from a height. And I just get the joy of having those words to apply to that. You might like to comment on that.
Yes, I think great writers are able to convey to us something that we already know but have never been able to express. And then we get the benefit, I suppose, not to talk too prosaically about it, but the benefit of being able to go back, as you have done with that image. And it continues to delight us. We enter into that experience again and again, and we keep being enriched by that experience, because somehow there's a sort of miracle that's happened where this person has been able to capture it in words. It always takes us back to reality, to what we know, but are not ordinarily able to express and to capture the nuances about our experience, which we live with, but we can't necessarily convey. So it's always this paradox that the poet is able to express what is otherwise ineffable, but it also, in expressing it, it points to the ineffability of it, the inexpressibility of it, both at the same time. So, that's why, I mean, I have my students memorise a few famous poems, just to give, because long after they've forgotten anything that I've had to say about a writer, if they remember the poems, they'll have this resource that they can draw on at all these different moments, all their lives. Yeah, exactly right. Yeah, and even today, I mean, it happened to me today. I was took my son to the Byzantine liturgy, the Orthodox liturgy, and we were walking afterwards, and he saw a dead bird on Gardner's Road, just outside the church at St. Spiridon, on Gardner's Road in Kingsford. And he said, "Dad, did you see that? There's this bird that was decaying, an Indian miner." And to me, immediately, words came to me from a poem, a wonderful poem by Jamal Shara, called A Small Song. There is a sparrow frozen on the lawn in the snow that lasted through the night and the cold dawn that killed it. Now sunlight drops about the corpse, a pall of white. So ends an unimportant life and brief. It spent some seasons lightly on this earth, then doubtless with relief, found one lung full of breath was all that stood between itself and death. So this is exactly what you're saying. You know, when you cross the harbour bridge and you look down and see the water, and then the water reminds you of the lines, but the lines take you deeper into the experience of the water. And so, of course, I recited the second verse of this poem to my 9-year-old, and he looked up at me a little bit quizzically. But it gave me great pleasure, even though I knew at this moment in his life he didn't understand the reference, that poem was able to make sense or partial sense of this thing that we've just seen, a dead bird. It's an ordinary thing and at the same time a cause of wonder.
My friends who are performers, be they actors, musicians, instrumentalists or singers, often say that audiences differ. And they differ in part because they're different and in part because the performance makes them different. Today, I knew that it was going to be an experiment, but I had great confidence that what Stephen would say to us would affect us all. And it has. It's been obvious standing up here how awestruck everybody is at what he had to say. So thank you very much indeed, Steve.
We've been listening to poet Dr. Stephen McInerney of Campion College, Sydney, speaking at the 19 November 2023 meeting of the Australian Catholic Historical Society. Dr. John Carmody moderated the Q&A. Alongside this podcast link on the ACHS website is a link to a PDF document which lists the poems read by Stephen and a timing indication as to where each is introduced by him. For those who, like me, needed to know more about the Chalcedonian definition to which Dr. Robert Gascoigne referred in the Q&A, there's also a link in the same document to a Wikipedia article. ACHS meetings are held at 2 p.m. on the third Sunday of each month from February to November in the Crypt of St Patrick's, Churchill, 20 Grosvenor Street, Sydney. Please visit the ACHS website for our 2024 talks program. ACH podcasts are produced by me, John Kenny. The Society acknowledges the traditional custodians of Gadigal country, upon which talks are recorded, of Wallametagal country, where the podcasts are made, and of all places in which our stream may be heard. We hope to bring you one more podcast before Christmas. Diana Carmody will be our guest speaker at the ACHS Christmas Luncheon. Bye for now.